Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
This morning with Rod Oram. Morena, Rod, how are you?
That's Maria, Rachel, very well, thank you.
Oh, that's good to hear. Well, let's start by talking about the Resource Management Act reforms, because it's a huge topic. We've kind of touched on it in the past, but I feel like it's a good time to maybe get a bit of an understanding about what's actually at stake here, what's changing, and why is it changing? This is a 30-year-old piece of policy, basically. What's going on with the Resource Management Act?
I want to make some big overall points to start with. First of all, the RMA was actually very leading edge in terms of this type of legislation around the world, which is trying to manage the environmental impacts at the same time as organizing better development of resources, whether they be built environment in cities or natural resources out more widely. However, the attempts to establish bottom lines in that legislation, you can only go this far and no further, and to make sure that there was suitable mitigation if there was environmental impacts, that's been very difficult to enforce over the years. And the key reason for that was successive governments had been very poor, very slow, and indeed ultimately failing on some, to put in place national policy statements which define those bottom lines. So, of course, the world's moved on a great deal, and New Zealand has a much larger population, much more call on resources. So this is a big effort that has been fundamentally led by some useful organizations in business, such as the Property Council and NGOs, particularly the Environmental Defense Society, which the previous government, Labour, is saying that they weren't in favor of a full reform. They were just going to keep tweaking the RMA. The EDS led a huge amount of work to map out what that alternative would look like. And the government has accepted that, and it's very last term of government, Ardern government set up the Randerson review panel, led by a retired appeals court judge, Tony Randerson, who had been very who played a key role in establishing the RMA originally 30 years ago. And the Randerson review has done a tremendous job of broadening out the work and adding to the work that had already been done. So that's what we've got now. The next thing to say about this, the RMA has not been biffed, which is what a fair few people are saying.
Yeah.
Some very key principles of the RMA have been carried through, but improved. So much so that a lot of the case law that's been built up around the RMA over the years will still apply to this new law, which I think is a very important test, because we're not going back to first principles.
No.
But this time around, though, it's much more about taking a complete sort of ecosystem view of environmental impacts and making sure those strong bottom lines are there, and not saying that you can, if you degrade the environment in this place because you are wanting to develop something that has a big negative impact on the environment there, that you can just sort of kind of make up for it somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I think those are the core things that are in play here.
So that seems like some fundamental changes, but as you say, it's kind of taking those original principles through into this new, the proposed sort of new policy that we're seeing. The issues that perhaps have been across the board sort of agreed upon is the complicated nature of the Resource Management Act as it sort of currently stands has meant it's a little bit unwieldy to use. Is the proposals from the government, in your opinion, looking like a more streamlined or a more easy to enforce, easy to understand way of dealing with our resource management in development and environmental protections? Is this something that you think is going to be successful?
These issues will never be easy to deal with because they are so complex, so multifaceted. But there will be greater clarity here, and there will be those very clear definitions and bottom lines from the government, which will avoid, hopefully, a lot of the inconsistency in the argument that's gone into trying to apply the RMA. So I think that's the big step forward. But then the next one is there's a companion law around spatial planning. So mm-hmm. that's taking a longer term view of what can happen where. So that development happens in a much more logical and less conflicted way. That's another big step forward. But the huge problem that still hangs over all this is, these are very complicated laws to administer, and many local government entities, we've got sort of 70 of them or so around the country, ranging from huge ones like Auckland Council, which is kind of a third of the country's population, to I think the West Coast District Council is the smallest, about 60,000 people. And it's very, very hard for many of these councils to have the expertise to be able to pay for enough staff who are skilled enough to do the work. And for me, that's still a missing thing in this, a very big missing part of this. That inevitably takes you down into the very deeply, deeply unpopular area of should there be some consolidation of territorial local authorities. And we're seeing how difficult that is with water right now. So that's a reservation I still have. I also have a very big political reservation, because Judith Collins was completely misunderstood what the Randerson Review was actually reporting. And she said it vindicates exactly what we're saying. Look, two separate laws, you know, one for planning and one for the environment. That is completely wrong. The key piece of legislation here brings together development and planning and the environment in one place. And then the spatial planning is a different kind of overlay about the long term. Now, I'm not sure that national support is completely in the bag for this. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a very, very important thing to watch as the parliamentary process unfolds. The draft document already available, and then through the select committee process, that's going to be tuned up. But certainly the feedback from all relevant and sensible parties, like NGOs, like major business organizations and the rest, is very positive, saying things to tune up in the select committee process, but so far so good.
Now, I do want to talk about the Hauraki Gulf, but I did want to ask you before we move on to that, do you think that climate change is being factored enough into the overall design of this new policy? Is it something that we're seeing as core to the issues going forward, particularly like around big infrastructure, or are we seeing it kind of separated out? Is this something that you're worried about or you think is heading in the right direction?
It's better, but not all the way there. And we indeed need, in addition to this, an adaptation bill, because there is lots we need to effects of the climate crisis that we need to deal with aren't adequately met in the existing legislation or this proposal. So climate change isn't as fundamental to this legislation as it needs to be. That's true across all legislation. It's across the whole government mm-hmm. process. It's across how society is responding. It's how business is responding. We're far from being there yet of understanding how deeply, deeply fundamental the co-crises of climate and biodiversity loss are, and how they've got to be solved together, because they are our life support system. It's absolutely as simple and crystal clear as that, but very few people actually have locked on to that, I'd have to say, deeply fundamental truth.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of life support systems, the Hauraki Gulf, it's a big one. It supports a lot of our ecosystem. And we are seeing some new restrictions and new protections put into that area. The government's taking a more, I guess, focused policy stance on it. What are your, I guess, initial responses to the moves we're seeing made in Parliament around this at the moment?
I'm very excited, because the Hauraki Gulf is a mess in terms of loss of species. Crayfish are, quote, functionally extinct in the Hauraki Gulf now. The high point up to this was the sea change process, which brought together all stakeholders on land and sea, because what happens on land has a huge impact what happens in the Gulf, i.e. sediment and stormwater and sewage and the rest getting into the Gulf. Sea change was a very difficult process to get those stakeholders to achieve commonality and make some very bold proposals, which they did. But that was in the very end of 2016, and nothing happened until now. But David Parker, who is also the Environment Minister, but is also Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, our first Oceans Minister, has grasped that nettle. And building on a very useful report on fisheries by the Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor, Julia Gerard, which came out a couple of months ago, which laid the issues bare once again, not the least of which the huge dysfunction amongst within stakeholder groups and then between stakeholder groups on all our sea and oceans policy. And Gerard made a very, very important recommendation that the existing Fisheries Act, which I think goes back to the early 90s, 1992 or so, actually has room in there, has mechanisms in there to set quotas for individual species based on the ecosystems issues around those species. Because we've got a quota management system now which is reasonably effective, but all it does is try to control fishing to stop that population of that species collapsing. It doesn't look at the wider ecosystem issues in which the species live. So that's a very big step forward. Another very interesting and good example of a rare one of moving to that ecosystem view of things. Then there's some changes on trawling, but a very big one is in bycatch, i.e. what gets scooped up in nets, which is the trawl the fishermen don't want, but discard at sea. But now the rules around bycatch, around what's discarded, will be simplified but strengthened, but they will be required by law to bring that to land their bycatch, so we can understand, so scientists can understand more about what's going on out there.
It's a big change, that one.
A very big one. And there's lots of other changes there. I think this is a really good package. Parker's clearly determined to do more. He gave a very good speech on all this to the Forest and Bird Annual General Meeting a few weekends ago. But the very big one on top of that still to do is oceans policy. We are responsible for the fourth largest oceanic resource in the world. That's our exclusive economic zone. It's huge. A lot of it's the Southern Ocean, which is the least stressed and degraded of oceans. And we don't actually have oceans policy. It's extraordinary. So that's the next big thing. And Parker won't, at least in the conversation I had with him, won't be drawn on that in particular, but I know he's keen. And again, it's the EDS stepping up. They'd previously done a lot of good work on seas. They were very much behind the science and bringing people together in sea change on the Hauraki Gulf. They're just about to deliver their next big piece of work on an oceans policy, and that would be a really, really important thing to get to work on in the next term, assuming that all the RMA changes can go through in this term. I'm mindful of how big a workload Park has got.
It's going to be a really big job, that one, actually, but very interesting to see how it rolls out. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Rod Oram. It's always great to have you on the show. Have a lovely couple of weeks, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Yes, thank you. On all these fantastically interesting and incredibly important stories.
So important, hey. Hey, thanks very much, Rod. We'll talk to you soon. Ka kite.
Bye.
You just heard a bit of political commentary
with Rod.